Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation, on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I call your name, the echo is haunting, the echo is always the same. I call your name, the echo is haunting, an echo can never be changed. So I call your name.
And welcome to Signs of Life Radio. I'm your host, Bob Ginsberg. We have a terrific guest today. Actually, I got to meet our illustrious guest a week or two ago. I lose track of time in California. I loved her book, which is called Proof of Spiritual Phenomena. Dr. Mona Sabani is a cognitive neuroscientist who holds a doctorate from the University of Southern California. She completed a postdoctoral fellowship at Vanderbilt University with MacArthur Foundation Law and Neuroscience Project. A former research scientist at the University of Southern California, she also was a scholar with the Sachs Institute for Mental Health Law, Policy, and Ethics. And her work has been featured in the New York Times, Vox, and other media outlets. As I mentioned, she's the author of Proof of Spiritual Phenomena, a neuroscientist's discovery of the ineffable mysteries of the universe. And her website is Mona Sabani, and Sabani is SOBHANIPHD.com. Welcome, Mona. Nice to see you again.
Hi, nice to see you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, as I said, I love the book. We just added it today to our recommended reading list, and I think it'll mean a lot to a lot of people. So I guess a good place to start off, I mean, obviously you were educated and trained as a material scientist. I'd venture to say that Proof of Spiritual Phenomena is a book that you could never have envisioned writing. So, I mean, were there any particular personal experiences that kind of shifted you to explore such things?
Oh my goodness. I never wanted to write the book. Sometimes I still regret it. No, I'm just kidding. But I was very, very much a scientific materialist, skeptic. I didn't believe in anything really, especially after my training, my PhD training, because they train us like that to be very skeptical and believe the universe is random and meaningless. So I had, it started for me because of my Persian background. My grandmother and my mother they drink it where the grounds stay in the cup and they form pictures. And then if you have an intuitive look at the pictures, they can intuit things about your life. And my grandmother and my mom, my grandmother was really good. My mom is really good. And my mom would read for me. And so a lot of the things that she said would come true. And I couldn't reconcile it with my science, so I just kept it very separate in my head, just completely lived in cognitive dissonance for a long time. But I trusted them, like I believed it, because I had seen, you know, over 10 or more years at that point that it was pretty, not everything was true, but you know, it gave you a general sense of the direction of things. So that was the first, what flipped me into actually kind of discarding the cognitive dissonance or deciding to explore this more deeply was I had two big emotional life events that my mom saw in the coffee. One was the death of someone, and then the other was the ending of a relationship. And then I was already having an existential crisis. So with those two events on top of all of that, I just kind of lost my footing. I lost my foundation. And then I got curious about, I was like, I don't understand life anyway. I might as well just explore whatever this, I didn't know it was called divination at the time, but I was like, let me explore these readings, whatever they are. And so then that launched me on my journey.
Yeah. You know, when I was reading the book, I mean, you mentioned that you used to brush off synchronistic and coincidental experiences as lies of your brain, which we can get into after this. Here she is talking about coffee readings. I mean, talk about being an open-minded scientist. I mean, that's kind of the de definition of it, So it's
Yeah,
interesting.
I think the personal experience drives it home,
So what about that? I mean, you did write that obviously you've spent a good part of your academic career studying the brain, and you wrote in the book that very often, our brain lies to us. What did you mean when you wrote that?
So our brains are coincidence detectors. They look for coincidences because they're trying to make meaning of the information that's coming in. And you have to make meaning of the information that's coming in to survive as an organism, right? You have to understand, is something a threat, or is this a potential mate or whatever it is. So you have to create meaning, and your brain is trained to do that. And so the humans in particular are really interesting. I mean, I can't go into all of the interesting neuroscience studies here, but there are a lot of really interesting studies that show that our two hemispheres have two different personalities, like literally different personalities. And your left hemisphere in particular is likes to weave stories and likes to kind of be the one that's more narrow-minded and doesn't like new information, whereas your right hemisphere tends to be a little more holistic. So, like in these patients, we call them split brain patients because their hemispheres were the bundle that connects them was cut in some of them, and then you would see these two different personalities. So when you do that, you find that when the left hemisphere doesn't have an answer for something, it just makes something up. Like the it won't admit that. It doesn't have the answer that it, 'cause it doesn't like to be wrong. So it'll just make something up. And the other thing our brain does is there's too much information coming in. So it creates shortcuts, which we call biases, which most people are familiar with. The reason you have biases is because your brain's like, oh, I learned this one time. I don't want to spend energy on this again. So I'm just going to use this shortcut. So that's when you come up, that's when you encounter things like confirmation bias or hindsight bias. I don't know if I put this in the book, but like I always use the example of like, oh, Prius drivers are the worst drivers because you had, one experience with a Prius driver and then now you think they're the worst. And every time a car cuts you off, you remember the times it was a Prius and forget the times when it wasn't. And so, but it's not a mistake of your brain. That's how it's designed, to kind of save itself energy and save itself time. But so that's what I mean by lying to you. So it does that. And the other thing is, which is different from animals, humans have, which is more psychological, they have egos. And the ego complex likes to protect you and your feelings and your emotions. So that's where you see all these psychological defenses that come up, where, and that's also, you're lying to yourself, you're lying to others. And again, it's not on purpose and it's not nefarious and it's not, like something that's wrong with us. That's just the way we're built. And all of these are for our protection. But obviously, they don't serve us and work that well for us in every circumstance.
The brain tends to prioritize and favor information that lines up with our existing beliefs.
Exactly.
So I guess that's why so many people just simply can't be convinced of things that challenge these beliefs that are hardwired in their brains, right?
Yeah, and there is a lot of that. And in the beginning, when I got started on this journey, that aspect of it is what troubled me so much and caused my mind to go in circles and cause so much mental anguish because I kept questioning myself, right, or my experiences or brushing things off. And the way around that is one, to look at scientific studies, which is why I put those in the book, because then it's not confirmation bias. And the second thing is, if you do take careful notes, like let's say you keep a dream journal, then like and you meticulously, which is what I did. So I would have precognitive dreams, but then I would brush them off. And so I started keeping a dream journal to be like, Maybe I'm just remembering the few times when, something from my dream lines up with reality the next day. But I started keeping a dream journal, and I wasn't editing anything. I wasn't, cutting anything out. And then through that practice, I realized that, to some extent, you can't, like, if you're doing it, you can't totally rule out confirmation bias or whatever. But, at least to the best of your ability, I'm like, okay, I know I write down every dream. So, and every detail. And so now I can use this to prove to myself that I'm not, editing out the things that would say that I'm not having precognitive dreams.
So it's like a fail-safe system that you've invented on your own to make sure your brain's not lying to you. While we're talking about the brain, so I have a friend named Lori, who's also a volunteer for the foundation, and she emailed me a question the other day, and she wanted to know where memories are stored. And most people, I gave the best answer that I could, but most people, if you ask where memories are stored, they'll say, well, of course they're stored in the brain. But is true, are all mem do you think that all memories are stored in the brain, or could they be stored elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, if you asked me before this journey, I would have been like, duh, of course they're in the brain. But
Right.
now I'm not so sure. And honestly, neuroscience doesn't have, like, we know that this area of the brain called the hippocampus is responsible for laying down new memories. And we know that it's really important in memory, like memory formation and things like that. But it's actually still up for debate whether memories are stored in individual neurons or if they're stored in distributed patterns of energy across the brain, or like we don't actually know. So even in neuroscience, there isn't a very good answer, and the theories are always evolving. And now, after I've been on this journey, I mean, I think there's a lot of really, when you go outside of neuroscience or you go outside of the hard sciences and you go into psychology or transpersonal psychology or any of this other literature, you start to see. And even now, with I think with epigenetics, people are opening their minds a little bit, but it's like your body remembers your trauma, which is a type of memory. So there's already a type of memory in your body that's not in your brain. Who's to say there's not other types? And I think on my journey too, I had all these like friction, these really deep friction points, and then one was consciousness, coming from the brain. Which is related to memory. And I couldn't let that one go for a long time until I started reading philosophy and realizing there were other worldviews or theories where maybe consciousness is fundamental. And if that's true, maybe memory is a part of that. And so there have been some recent that I put in my book. There's a model from, I think he's actually a philosopher, but it's a neuroscience paper, and he puts a model out, a very detailed one, for how the brain might be a receiver interacting with a field. And he talks about the exact frequencies and the exact brain regions involved in like downloading and uploading consciousness and memory. So I think there's a lot of, I think it's possible. I think it's possible. I think there's a lot of unexplained evidence and stories and case histories. So yeah, I don't
Yeah,
think anyone knows.
I agree. The strong argument, and I mean, you've wrote about mediumship research in your book. So, if the medium research is correct, it shows that discarnates retain memory and personality. So, if they retain memory, there's obviously no brain. So, there has to be a field by which memories continue. So, I mean, so we have to be open to that. Would you mind taking or fielding a question from a caller? Okay, we have Lisa from New Jersey. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, thank you, both of you. I appreciate this this call. Because I've been wondering, going to the psychic area and the medium area. And I think you kind of answered this, but I was wondering, that brings me to another question. I was going to ask you if there's a spot in the brain where they found that, but it doesn't seem that, like, if where they didn't find it with memory, and did they find it with that, Or have they talked about the communication between, I can't remember the name of the sac, like where your organs are? Because in mediumship and psychic, I get a feeling in between my throat and my belly button, that feeling, the sense, or psychic specifically, and getting that feeling specifically there and knowing. It's just a knowing. It's not in the brain, it's a knowing. But what have they studied between the brain and that feeling sense? I don't know what to call it. I don't know if there's a technical term for it.
So brain studies are really expensive, and there haven't been that many done on psychics. I mean, it's hard to get even normal neuroscience funded, much less something like this. There's practically no funding for it. But I do know that the little work that's been done, well, let me say this first. There's the states that you go into called altered states of consciousness that put your brain into a different set of frequencies. Those are known to reliably elicit, more, what do I call it, information from wherever. As for a specific part of the brain, there has been so little research on this, but I know of like one study. I mean, there were a few studies, but again, they've not been replicated. But this one was really interesting. And it's by Gary Nolan at Stanford, actually. I think they took really high achieving, really successful people who reported, like, oh, I follow my gut. They didn't call it psychic. It was people who are very intuitive. Scanned their brains and did like a structural analysis, and they found that this part of the brain called the caudate, and closely related to it's the putamen, but it's basically this deep structure inside your brain, kind of more the primitive, quote unquote, old areas of the brain, which, to be honest, neuroscientists are not exactly sure what these. I mean, they know they're involved in motor control and whatever, but we don't know that much about them. So they found that those areas ha had hyperconnectivity in people who are highly intuitive. And I hope I'm not totally messing up this study because it wasn't published. I just heard him talk about it. But they were so interested in the results that they're like, let's scan their partners or someone in their family as controls. I think it was partners. They're like, let's scan their partners as controls. And they found that their partners had the same odd hyperconnectivity in that part of the brain. And they compared both of these to the general population and found that the odds of even one person having it was extremely low, but the odds of that person finding another person who has it was like extremely, extremely, extremely rare. So he makes this like interesting argument, yeah, that he's like, it's almost like a separate species of human like forming, that these people find each other somehow. They don't know it's happening, it's totally unconscious, but that it happened. So that was the most interesting study I heard of. And what's also interesting is that I can't remember which psychic or medium it was, but it was someone like from the ni early 1900s, maybe, or somewhere between 1900 and maybe 1960, which is a wide range. I know, I'm sorry, I can't remember exactly what it was. There was a psychic or medium who said, like, the part of the brain that is related or receives psychic information is the caudate, which is interesting because I don't think many neuroscientists or, and definitely not the general lay public, would even know what the caudate was, back then. I mean, now, still, it's not very interesting. And I love neuroanatomy, but I know other people don't. So that's, yeah, there hasn't been a lot of research, but I would say that's the most interesting thing I've read so far.
That is interesting. Can you spell the caudate, that word, for me, please?
Yes, it's
C
Caudate.
oh, okay, that's okay. Oh, that's interesting. Thank you. I'm going to do some research on that. So there's really, is there any connection that they found between the brain and then the feeling sense of the body, in the torso? Have they made
So
any connections with that?
I don't know about it from a paranormal, parapsychological, psychic. I haven't seen studies like that, but I do know in regular neuroscience, there's a lot of work done on that. Actually, I worked with the people who did that theory at USC for my dissertation. But Antoine Bechara is the neuroscientist who did that work, and and Antonio and Hannah DiMazio. So they have a theory called the somatic marker theory, and it's about that. It's about connecting the feelings in your body to your brain. And they did this really interesting experiment with card decks, like just card decks, and they had this gambling game, and some of the decks would be riskier, gambling wise than the other decks. And they found that unconsciously, like if they asked the participants if they noticed a difference between the decks, they would say no, but they noticed that people who were like risk averse started avoiding the risky decks, and then people who were like, and then they also found that they would start sweating too. Like if they started reaching or pulled a card from a risky deck, they would all automatically start sweating. So that's normal neuroscience, actually. And then I just remembered Julia Mossbridge did do some that experiment, and she just looked at the time frame, I think, before the action to, and that would be precognitive or intuitive. And she did find a significant difference that, so she found something that was like they didn't even look at that time frame in the normal studies, because they wouldn't think anything's happening there. But if you do that, you do find a significant effect.
Well,
Okay,
thank
well,
you so much. Thank
thank you,
you.
Lisa, for calling. Have a good rest of the evening. So, Mona, when you started out on this exploration, I mean, you were studying things like ESP and presentiment and Ganzfeld and remote viewing, things you had never really looked at before. So, what was your initial reaction when you read the data?
Yeah, I was really surprised because there was this narrative, I guess, that parapsychological research is really poorly done and that it's not well controlled, that, it's all fraud. But then when I read the research, I found that there had been like over 100 years of it done, and in many different labs, in many different countries on different continents. Like, so fraud was kind of unlikely. And then also that there actual like experimental protocols were very similar, some of them, to what we use in normal neuroscience and psychology. So that was really surprising. I would say actually upsetting. I was upset about it at the time. But yeah, it was very surprising. But it made it easy for me to assess those experiments because I was already familiar with them, so I didn't have to familiarize myself with like the methods. That really shocked me. And they were very, very, very well controlled, and they were much better controlled than a lot of the normal research that we do. So I was, it was pretty shocking because I thought, wow, this is not the matching up with what I thought this research would be.
Yeah. You also wrote about and studied past life regression. I think you even took part in that yourself
I
personally.
did.
So, I mean, are you convinced that it's really evidential of reincarnation?
I think so. I did a lot. I dug into this a lot because I really wanted to know. So I wouldn't use that as the gold standard for that. I would use the research from the University of Virginia.
Right.
I think that's just better research. But well, plus I don't think anyone's done official research on past life regression because it's a therapeutic. And so there's hasn't been a lot of, again, funding, no research done on that. But I also think it would be difficult to, unless it's like very specific details that you can give, it would be difficult to really locate the person that you were. So, and the few researchers who do past life regression who published anything about it, I read everything, and I thought some of it's interesting, but again, I would not be convinced that that would prove that reincarnation is real. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was surprised when I started looking into reincarnation that most of the well-known scientists who study reincarnation were somewhat skeptical. I don't know if skeptical is the right word, but they didn't think the evidence from past life regression was as reliable because you're in such a suggestive state because you're in the hypnosis. But yet, as you write about, sometimes you're able to talk about evidential things that can be researched, right? And,
Yes. I mean, there are some really interesting stories from Brian Weiss and Roger Wilger and Michael Newton. And then just like, I just remember this one from, I think it was Brian Weiss's book. One of them, it was like a mother got a past life regression and had a difficult relationship with her daughter, and then gets this whole past life, whatever. And then the daughter, unbeknownst to the mother, like goes, I think, and went and got a past life regression and ha recounted the same exact story. And she had not heard her mother's, like her mother had not told her, or whatever. It was something like, it was incredibly odd, the odds of that happening, the details with which they had overlap on the life. I think those kinds of things are really fascinating. And they're, like, how could you explain that? Like an
Yeah,
anomaly.
absolutely. So, when you achieve an altered state of consciousness, whether that's meditation or being immersed in nature or music or even psychedelics, is that sort of a way of bypassing the analytical brain and just
Yeah.
allowing information to flow, like the filter is down?
Yes. Yeah. So our analytical mind, and our ego talks all the time, constantly talking. It's very noisy, and so you need to kind of get into a relaxed state where that calms down. I think to be able to allow basically other patterns that are probably always there, but that you just can't hear or receive, to come through.
You talk about in the book spiritual experiences, and mystical experiences. So how would you describe, like, what is a spiritual experience? Maybe I shouldn't be asking this at Mona the neuroscientist, but Mona the person.
Yeah, what a good question. I don't know that I've ever been asked that. Well, I asked myself recently, what does spiritual mean? Because I just realized it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And when I say spiritual, to me, it means, because I think to scientific materialists or something, to them, it means finding meaning in life. But like, you're finding the meaning, but they might still consider that spiritual. But to me, it means connection to an actual spiritual or mystical dimension of the universe, which to me is a non-physical place or space. Yeah. And so an experience would then be interaction with that space.
I mean, I sort of have a silent giggle every time you talk about non-physical as a material neuroscientist.
That was very
It
hard.
shows you where you are now compared to where you were. So, I mean, any advice you can give people on ways to reach these altered states of consciousness to maybe help receive the non-physical information on their own?
There's so many good meditations. Like the HemiSync is really great from the Monroe Institute. I love that one. And breath work of any kind is really great for that. Not even like the full, what's it called? Not even a holotropic breath work is really intense and like a whole day thing, but there are other versions like neurodynamic breath work where, it's like an hour and a half or something. And you can get into a really deep state and release energy from your body and emotions, and then receive insights. I've seen, I'm assuming past lives. I don't know. I saw a lot of images during breath work that I have no idea what they were, who they were, but they were like full on movies. So I think breath work is good. Meditation is good. Using sound for meditation, like the HemiSync, but any other kind, is helpful, I think, because I think for some people to just sit and follow your breath is kind of hard. For Westerners, very difficult in this day and age. So I think sound is very helpful. There's also, if you have this technology, I mean, you can also use these like light goggles that also entrain. It's like a flickering light, which also puts you in a meditative, a pretty deep meditative state. And I mean, yeah, psychedelics are great, but obviously not for everyone. There's also transcendent technology. So there's, depending on where you live, there's all these new technologies emerging. So some of them are individual, like VR stuff, but some of them, if you live in a city, there's like these art installations or whatnot, and you can go in and, you know, they'll be like changing light and no edges in the room. And those can put you in a really, really deep, you can go into the question, just relax, have the experience, and come
Yeah.
out there.
So right now there's a lot of, for the first time in a long time, there's a lot of psychedelic research that's going on, and it's sort of reaching the mainstream. They're finding all sorts of application, you know, everything from grief to trauma. So you think that's the future? That's gonna, you know, maybe one day that'll provide the answer to the nature of consciousness.
I hope so. My scalp is tingling like crazy.
Yeah.
Look, I'm one of those people now. But I mean, I love psychedelics. I love psychedelic research because it's an easy way to talk about this, or it's an easier way to talk about this stuff with scientific materialists, even though they try to ignore the transpersonal or spiritual aspects. You kind of can't. It's, you know, it's up to some point, and a lot of the I would say a lot of the initial research that was done out of Johns Hopkins from Roland Griffith's group focused on the mystical experience because psychedelics are known, high doses of psychedelics are known to elicit mystical experiences. And the way that they describe that is an experience that feels ineffable, meaning you like cannot describe it to another person. You have no language to, you know, to explain what happened to you or what you saw or felt. They ha tend to have a noetic quality. You tend to come back feeling positive. So there's a few dimensions they use to define a mystical experience, but they found that the people who had mystical experiences on the psychedelic were the ones to have the best outcomes, like in terms of depression and the best long term. So like that lasted 3 months follow up, 6 months follow up. So, and the thing that's been studied the most, actually, I shouldn't say that because there's been a lot of studies that have come out now, but initially the most research was done on depression and or end of life. So like end of, if you had cancer and it was end of life, they were doing it with patients like that. So yeah, so there is like a correlation between, of course, the scientists are trying to dissociate that or be like, no, it's just the chemical. It's just affecting a network. The meaning has nothing to do with it, but there's still a question around that, around like if we is it your experience in a psychedelic that heals you or is it the chemical? Likely you it's both, like most things, but they have to do the research to find out. So something like if you put someone on an anesthetic and their consciousness is out and then you give them a psychedelic, you know, that would help answer that. So I think that research is going to start to be done, but a lot of them, you know, people have like they'll have telepathy. Actually, in the 50s to 70s, there was a lot of research among psychotherapists using LSD. It was big in the field. People who are manufacturing LSD were just shipping it to psychotherapists, and they were using it in small doses, large doses. And it was very common and not shocking at all to talk amongst each other to say, like, I felt like I could hear like my patient's thoughts, or like we could communicate telepathically, or I could feel his emotions. So that kind of thing happens. And then if you're taking something like ayahuasca with visions or spirits or whatever's coming into your awareness, sometimes you can get information about, you know, like someone's passed away at a distance, you didn't know they were going to pass away. You get the information at a trip, you come back, and it turns out to be true. Like there's a lot of really interesting stories like that. I mean, it's not interesting to you and me because we're like, duh, of course. But to Western, like to scientific materialists, They're dumbfounded by that. They're like, well, how could that be? You could, we're in the Amazon.
Yeah.
How could you know your son died in New York?
I know. You know, I find it interesting, as you're talking, is that the word ineffable is used both in near-death experiences and in psychedelic research, experiences. Those are two times that you most often hear that word because people just can't put it into language,
Yeah.
We're talking with Dr. Mona Sabani. Her book is Proof of Spiritual Phenomena, a neuroscientist's discovery of the ineffable mysteries of the universe. Let's take another call, or if you would, we have Tim from Pittsburgh. Hello, Tim.
Hi, good evening.
Good
Good evening.
evening.
Hi, Dr. Sahani. Thank you very much for taking my call. I appreciate your background and the work that you've done. I took a look at your book online and actually ordered it today. So, in a nutshell, here's my background and here's where I'm coming from. I started as a physics and astronomy major and basically got frustrated because the teaching related to that was basically shut up and calculate. And I had bigger questions than that. I morphed into biological psych, biological basis of behavior and sensation, ultimately got involved in order to make money in health administration, and ultimately became a lawyer and did get involved similar to what you did with mental health law. I've taught ethics, et cetera. So I'm not a scientist. I don't hold myself out to be one, but I think we have some aspects of shared backgrounds. In regard to that, I have not had these individual experiences that a lot of people have had. We've had some quirky things happen regarding people who have passed, but I've never had an out-of-body experience or anything like that. But I've done a lot of reading on different things. And when I talk to people about all of what we've been talking about, they will say to me, "Do you really believe in this stuff?" And my response is, I believe in the possibility that something else outside of what we take as our day-to-day functioning is going on. And I have talked with people saying, there's no such thing as color. It's what your brain is looking at. There's no such thing as pitch. And I do music also. And I said, all of the wonderful musical sounds, that's all created in your brain, and it's coming from energy that is being transmitted. The reality around us is really much different than what, our brain tells us that it is. So here's where I'm coming from. If you go back to Newton, they talk about laws of motion, and then Einstein comes along and says, there's something called the speed of light, and that affects different things depending upon how fast you travel, and gravity is affected in certain ways. Bottom line is, 100 years after Einstein, even though he showed via the math that this worked, and folks like Arthur Eddington showed that, yeah, space really does bend around gravitational areas, they still call it a theory. They don't call it a law. And the bottom line is, from all of what you've looked at and your background, what would you say would be the breakthrough where we would be able to say that whatever it is, and I don't even want to say it's outside our reality, but it's not part of our typical day-to-day reality where we talk about life before life, we talk about all of, out-of-body experiences and all of the things, rather than moving it, just talking about it anecdotally, is there something that you could talk about that you see maybe for the future that would bring all of this information into something that people would say, there's actual scientific validity to this? And I appreciate all of the stuff that the Noetic Institute is doing and all of that, that people could say there already is evidence of this, but it's not generally acceptable in, in the regular folks that are out there. Is there something that you see in the studies that you've made or you're thinking about this, that this would actually become much more mainstream and acceptable?
Well, I think that part of the problem is, so just to echo, there is a lot of evidence. And I think the reason that people cannot accept it has nothing to do with the evidence and has everything to do with themselves, unfortunately. And until we solve that problem, nothing you present to them is going to convince them. And I think we've see that every day on the news or with all these world events. Like, if you want, you cannot, you really can't force people to believe something they don't want to believe. Like, I'm just speaking from old me perspective, you could not convince her of anything. Like, I had to fall apart to open up. But having said that, I've thought about this too. And I would say I don't have a specific experiment or something, but I've thought a lot about how I feel like the spiritual, like I gave the definition earlier, to me, spiritual, mystical dimension or whatever, something is non-physical. However, it must be interacting with the physical, otherwise we would not be perceiving it. And this is using a materialist or physicalist, I think, perspective, or with an addendum that there's other dimensions that may not be physical. If you went to a different worldview completely, like panpsychism, then or idealism, we wouldn't even have be having this conversation. You'd be like, consciousness is fundamental. Like, how are we gonna get around that? You're not going to. But let's say it's a physicalist system, but there's another dimension that's non-physical. There must be an interaction point because we are able, some people are able to perceive, right? And so I would focus there. And I would look at people who, like the really exceptional ones, you know, the Forever Family Foundation, you know, screens for, but people with really exceptional skills who can kind of, they're like literally the word medium is very appropriate. They're mediums. Not between the worlds only, but between people with, you know, who don't have skills like that and in the other world. So I think that I would focus there. I don't have a specific experiment. I don't know what it would look like. You know, I think it would take a group of interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary scholars to figure that out. And not only scholars, I think we should include intuitives. I think spiritual people should be included. I put that in my book. I was like, I think there should be more conversation because I think it's really interesting that we use all these words about light, like the light came back to your eyes. You light up when you talk about that. And we never think about why we say those things. And then you have, you know, one day you watch it, I'm speaking on my behalf, one day you watch a show on psychics and you're like, why are they talking about light so much? Or like light between us, you know? And I think that kind of thing, I think that through language or phenomenology, we can gain a lot of insights. Scientists can bring, you know, experimental methodology. Mediums and psychics could bring phenomenology. And then we'll have anthropologists and others for context. But that's where I would focus. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I might also add, in the legal system, we have to prove proof beyond reasonable doubt. And something that Bruce Grayson said at one of our conferences quite a while ago, you can dismiss possibly the evidence from near-death experiences, which I think is probably the most compelling, and you can dismiss the evidence from mediumship research, and you can dismiss the evidence from reincarnation, and you can go right down the line. But when you step back and you examine all of it from a bigger perspective, the only explanation that makes sense collectively is that we're more than our physical bodies. And I think that's the best that we're going to do for now until people like Mona bring us some other hard data.
Yeah, but like it would be interesting. So, for example, I'll just use two. I just had this thought. Like, if you're using healing as an example, sometimes when healers will say, "Oh, a being has," I was just doing this paper, reading Ion's paper. That's why this is on my mind. Like, when people are doing a healing session, healers often say, "There's a being. Oh, there's an angelic being here helping, or their guides are helping remove something." And it's like if you could measure the difference in the body. You know, if they're saying like, oh, they're whatever it is, if they could, they're removing a negative thought or they're removing this emotion. Like if there was some way that you could measure that, which sounds ridiculous to us right now because we can't do that. And we're nowhere near being able to do that. But if you could do something like that, I think that would be interesting.
The folks that I've talked to, and by the way, I agree with both what you and Bob have said in regard to this. The scientific folks that I've talked to have said a couple of things. Number one, they said, well, if I was to do all of the reading that you did in all these different areas, I might come to the same conclusion. But quite frankly, I don't have time for all of that. So do you
Oh,
have
yeah.
something that you can present to me, in a very straightforward way? And I know you really have to look at all of this different evidence to really start turning your mindset around. Then they also said, well, you've got two other problems. Number one, if what you're saying is true, it would upset all of science because what you're indicating is there's this other, what they call reality, which can impact on our reality in ways that we're not 100% sure of. And that's going to mess up all of these scientific experiments where you have independent and dependent variables. And then the final thing they say is, plus, what you're saying is not congruent exactly with all the religions out there. So everybody that believes all of these different religions would have to change their mindset to adapt to what actually is and what the evidence shows. And he says that is something that would take, an awful long time if it would ever occur. This is,
Yeah.
I mean, after discussions that I've had and thinking about it, it's my huge frustration about this because we talk about all of this and this show, which I've listened to quite a bit, always ends with saying, and science is going to prove it. And I'm like, yes, absolutely. But how is science going to prove it? And I'm, hopefully in my lifetime that will happen. Something will occur. I don't know whether it's Gary Schwartz working on his soul phone or something else that people look and say, there is something to this, where there's something created that can get in touch with this other, if you will, reality that we can gather all of this evidence and we can do it through, as you're talking about, through psychedelics and all other kinds of things. And it's all interesting and it all adds to the evidence pile, but it never seems to be determinative for a lot of folks unless they spend a lot of time looking at this or
Yeah.
they've had experiences on their own. And, for myself, obviously, I'm frustrated with this. And I just hope that folks like you, Dr. Sohani, will continue to, push the envelope on this.
Thank you. I agree. Wait, can I just say something? But I wanted to say I totally recognize that because I came up against that problem too about my colleagues definitely do not have time to read this research. They don't even have time to read their own research. So one of my colleagues and I put together two retreats last year for scientists to talk about this stuff, and we didn't get to do quite what we wanted to do, but we will. And one of the intentions was that was to summarize the research. And not on a PowerPoint, like in some creative, fun way to get the main points to them to say, this is what's important about this research, and this is all you have to know. But like you said, and as I personally experienced, the scientific research is still not enough to flip you for good. There's like you go back and forth. I would wake up every morning and be like, oh, you idiot, you fell for it. And then I would have to review the research again. And then it wasn't until the personal experiences started to kick in that I was like, oh, okay, I see. And like nobody, once you have a personal experience too, like nobody can tell you, like when you have scientific evidence and you have personal experiences and you have enough of them, it doesn't, you don't care what anyone says because you're like, you're wrong. And it doesn't
Right.
matter.
Well,
Thanks for calling, Tim. Appreciate it.
thank you both very much.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Take care. It's true, Marty. You could do 20 years of scientific research and form certain opinions based upon the data, but then have one profound personal experience And that's as powerful as the 20 years of scientific research. But let's talk a little bit about savants. Well, you touched upon it in the book, and it's interesting because a lot of savants have compromised brains, and yet they're capable of incredible things. You reminded me, I had known about it, but I'd forgot, Kim Peek, who could read, put two books next to each other, two separate and distinct books, read one book with his left eye and the other book with his right eye, and understand the content in what, 10 minutes or something like that.
Which is like nobody else can do that. Yeah, savants are very interesting because the classic neuroscience model says you're born and your brain is a blank slate and you acquire experiences and learn things as you grow up. But savants seem to be born, either with innate skills or knowledge or the ability to rapidly acquire them. Usually it's innate. And there's no, so the model that we have doesn't explain that. So it just doesn't work. But we don't give up the model, of course. But there's a lot of really interesting cases in neuroscience like that. Like sometimes if someone has a head injury, they can start speaking another language that they've never learned before fluently. They're very extremely rare cases, but they happen and they're totally unexplainable by neuroscience standards.
Yeah, I'm not like in the book, like in the research that Diane Powell's doing. I mean, some of the savants are incredibly psychic.
Yes,
I
that's
mean,
right.
go explain that. I mean, off the charts psychic. Yeah,
Yes.
statistically improbable to say the least. So we don't know what's going. Is it? Do you think that, again, going back to like the brain? It may be compromised and not working properly, but it's so it's kind of in the background while they're reaching other channels. I don't know how else to explain that.
That's a good question. I mean, something is definitely. Actually, I didn't think about that. That's a really interesting idea that there might be. I wonder if you can just receive from like any part of your body. Has anyone looked into that? I don't know, but
Well, there's
just
a
like.
lot of people that think that your heart is the center of communication, you know. So,
Yeah, so maybe your heart. I mean, maybe that's the sensor. Maybe we have it all wrong. Who knows? But yeah, I mean, if you want to stick with the brain, it's. The brain is basically like it's wiring, right? And so their brains are wired differently than normal, which means that we don't understand them at all. So we can't explain their innate abilities and skills. But yeah, maybe the way it's wired somehow enhances, maybe it's like that, the hyperconnectivity in the caudate or something where they just have access to information that the rest of us don't easily.
so we've only got a couple of minutes, so let me ask you this. I don't want to put you on the spot. So how different is Mona Savani today from the old Mona Savani?
Oh my gosh, old me would be horrified at new me. She wouldn't like me at all.
Yeah.
At all. I'm a lot different, but I'm a lot more chill. I'm a lot happier. I mean, I feel more supported. I have a more meaningful life, and I'm happy that I wrote the book. I'm happy that, I mean, sometimes I still can't. I've moved past it, but for a long time I couldn't believe it. I was like, I can't believe this happened to me. And I was bitter about it because who I was just my identity and I had to discard it and create a new one. And that was not easy.
Yeah. Well,
So,
but
yeah.
you also wrote, I mean, you still, Lauren, give people the wrong impression. You still very much believe in the scientific method.
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're
I think.
against
I think,
closed-minded allegiance to one model.
yeah, I think people, and luckily this doesn't happen a lot to me, but if it did, I would just tell them. If somebody counters it, I'll just be like, you really aren't qualified to have an opinion on this unless you've read all the research, just the way that I wouldn't be qualified to make a comment on a certain type of cancer research if I've never, like, if I have no idea what the literature literature is. Like, I wouldn't be able to comment on it. So you kind of, if it's a scientist, you can easily just say that.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, well, that's been great. Again, we're talking to Dr. Mona Sabani. The book is called Proof of Spiritual Phenomena, a Neuroscientist's Discovery of the Ineffable Mysteries of the Universe. Mona's website is Mona Sabani, SobhaniPhD.com. I recommend the book highly. There's a lot of science and personal stuff in there you'll find interesting. If you forget it, it's on our recommended reading list on the website. Mona, thanks so much for this hour that flew by. You'll have to join us again. I hope to see you again.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a delight.
Thanks. Good night, everyone.